Good afternoon. My name is Charlie Mitchell. I'm the State Legislative Director at the ACLU. And today, the Department of Homeland Security released their draft regulations for states to implement the Real ID program. Also, Department of Homeland Security today announced a delay in the implementation deadline. We have a panel of experts today to address questions about the regulations. We have Tim Sparapani from the ACLU, Jim Harper, the Director of Information and Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, Bruce Schneier, a security expert, technologist, and cryptographer, Nancy Zirkin, the Vice President and Director of Policy at the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, and Barry Steinhardt, the Director of the ACLU Technology and Liberty Project. What we're going to do is have each of our experts speak for a couple of minutes, and then we're going to open it up to questions. So if we want to start off with Tim Sparapani, Legislative Counsel for the ACLU.
Thank you, Charlie. I want to thank everyone for joining us this afternoon. I think the takeaway message, at least from the federal legislative and regulatory perspective, is that this is a marriage made in hell. You've got the people who brought you long lines at the DMV, along with the people who brought you Katrina at DHS, still getting together. And while actions from today, including the regulations, have simply postponed that period of time, essentially all we're doing is kicking the wedding date down the road 2 years. And that marriage is still going to be a one made in hell, and it's still one that we need to break up. Essentially, what has happened is that DHS at the 11th hour has recognized what everybody has been saying for almost 2 years, that the Real ID Act is absolutely unimplementable. It cannot be fixed. It cannot have regulations that can be offered to make it work, and that even though there's 162-odd pages of regulations trying to implement it, there are all sorts of problems that we've already identified just in this few hours since the regulations became available. So the message is this. We still need dramatic federal legislative action from Congress, and at least two senators and one member of Congress have got it exactly right. We've got Senators Akaka and Sununu from Hawaii and New Hampshire, respectively, members of both parties, along with Senators Leahy and Tester, who have figured out that Real ID still needs to be repealed. The regulations that DHS is trying to implement today cannot be fixed. And these senators have recognized, along with Congressman Tom Allen of Maine and his co-sponsors, about 10 of them, that we've got to wipe out the underlying act, that we've got to give the ability for all of the interested stakeholders to come together in a true negotiated rulemaking where they actually have room to negotiate. And that's the fatal flaw of both Senator Collins' approach and the DHS regs today, is that they claim that they're bringing experts together. But what they're left to negotiate over is just a small portion of the issues at stake. It's like 95% of the decisions have already been made, and they're bad ones. I'll be happy to go into further detail, but I think I should stop there and pass it back to Charlie Mitchell.
Okay. Jim?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for phoning in. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. I'm Jim Harper, Director of Information Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. It's a delight to join my new friends at the ACLU in what is sort of a strange bedfellows call, as we have done strange bedfellows hearings across the country at the state legislative level. I'm looking forward to the chance to get back to disagreeing with the ACLU about the things that are out there. But seriously, the regulations that came out of DHS today are a disappointment, but I suppose nobody expected the regulations to fix all of the problems with Real ID. They don't fix Real ID, and they can't fix a law that is so fundamentally flawed. We are looking to Congress to fix these problems. You know, Chairman Lieberman, the chairman of the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, called Real ID unworkable at the time that it passed, and I don't think the passage of time has changed any of that, and I don't think Chairman Lieberman thinks so either. Speaking of his committee, though, Secretary Chertoff testified recently to them, if we don't get it done now, someone's going to be sitting around in 3 or 4 years explaining to the next 911 commission why we didn't do it. And I find it quite ironic that today they proudly delayed implementation of Real ID by more than a year and a half. this raises the question of whether Real ID is a valid security tool or not. And the security people that have practical on-the-ground experience that work with identification understand better, I think, than a lot of federal leaders, the quality of identification as a security tool. I was at a meeting yesterday of State Department of Motor Vehicle people, and they recognized, none of them were able to refute the fact that identification is not a security tool against dedicated threats like terrorists, criminal organizations, that kind of thing. All across the country, in hearings, in state legislatures, where many legislatures have passed resolutions against Real ID, they're recognizing the flaws in the Real ID Act. Congress has yet to recognize these flaws because Congress has yet to have a hearing on Real ID. And that's something that Congress needs to do, is reconsider the law, have hearings, have up or down votes on whether there should be a national ID in this country. And I think if they do have up or down votes, a national ID will fail. Back to you, Charlie.
Okay, next, Bruce Schneier. Bruce?
Hey there. I'm Bruce Schneier. I'm a security technologist. I'm not a civil libertarian. I'm not a politician. I look at this stuff from a security perspective. And the worry I have is that Real ID identification doesn't provide the security people expect them to. I mean, it doesn't work the way people want. And I'm going to sort of give some intuitions about that. I've written more about it. When most people think of ID cards, they think of a piece of plastic with their name and photograph that they put in their wallet. I mean, that's right, but there's actually a lot more to any ID program. And what starts out with this is a simple device becomes a very complex security system very, very fast. And when people think about ID, they often think about how honest people would use them, how they would be checked out. The real question is how the system could be misused, how it can be made to fail, and how it can be exploited. So a couple of issues. The card itself, right, no matter how hard we make it to forge, it will be forged. We know this from credit cards, from any ID document. There will be forgeries. Even worse, there will be legitimate cards and fraudulent names. We see that again and again. Even if we guarantee that everyone who issued national ID cards couldn't be bribed, the cards are issued based on other ID documents, which are all easier to forge. We have to worry about lost cards. Right now, about 20% of all ID documents are lost annually. Any system of ID has to deal with that. So national ID won't be as ubiquitous as people think they are. And any ID system involves people, right? People who make mistakes. There will be problems verifying them. There'll be problems with making them work in context. All of these can be exploited. And what these mean are is that identification checks based on ID won't be as secure as we might think they are. Right? Jim had a real point. This ID-based security doesn't work as well as we think. Most important are the databases, right? National ID, any ID requires a back-end database. That's the biggest expense, it's the biggest problem, and it's the biggest security risk. A single ID will increase the risk of identity theft. The intuition is that one very powerful ID is now much more valuable if stolen. And I think it'll make identity theft worse than what you have now, which is a series of distributed IDs in your wallet. They're also, I'm not going to go into it, the whole security perception of identification being used as a substitute for intentionality. We'd love it if your ID card would say evildoer. If you're an evildoer, then they won't let you on the airplane. But it doesn't work that way. And once you divide people into two categories, trusted and untrusted, you leave the option of people using the untrusted path for malevolence. I did a whole essay on this a bunch of months ago. If you go to Google and type Real ID and my name Schneier, S-C-H-N-E-I-E-R, it's the second hit. And I urge you to sort of read a lot of the security discussions I wrote on Real ID. I'll take questions at the end.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. We'll turn it over to Barry Steinhardt.
Thank you, Charlie. I'm Barry Steinhardt, the Director of the Technology and Liberty Project at the ACLU. First, let me point out that there is a website associated with the ACLU, which is called realnightmare.org, that will have many of the documents that we'll be discussing posted on it. And probably most importantly, we've created a Real ID scorecard that will go through each element of these regulations, and they are voluminous. point by point and indicate whether or not the Department of Homeland Security has passed, failed, or gets an incomplete grade for their adherence both to privacy principles and for making a stronger, more secure driver's license. Just in the initial reading of the regulations, which we've only had for now a couple hours, it's quite clear that on all too many of the items, DHS is going to get an incomplete. There are simply many, many items where the department has punted the ball down the field and has not completed them. They range from how and whether or not various databases, which are required to be either consulted or constructed under the Real ID Act, will in fact be constructed, to whether or not, an extremely important question, whether or not the information on the card, particularly the information in the so-called machine-readable zone, that is the portion of the card which they've supposed to be a form of a barcode, will be encrypted, or whether it's simply going to be naked and open up to the private sector to harvest it. It's rather extraordinary when you think about it how many unanswered questions these regulations contain. I actually was a member of the negotiated rulemaking committee that I gather now DHS has agreed to at least consult, but not to reconvene for the purpose of creating the regulations. So the details are daunting and multiple, and DHS probably, they shouldn't be faulted here because they essentially they got a statute that's impossible to implement, but DHS has failed to answer the lion's share of those questions. I'll make one final comment, which is that if you read the regulations, you'll find beginning on approximately page 106 of the notice that was filed this morning, the department has conceded the extraordinary cost of this. They've conceded the estimate, which we think is probably a minimum estimate, which the parties involved themselves have described as a minimum estimate of the cost of the states at $11.2 billion. That was the estimate from the National Governors Association, National Conference of State Legislatures. And they had estimated the full cost to individuals who will be required to obtain these licenses and the various documents to verify their identity, et cetera, at $23.2 billion. That's $23.2 billion. This is a real nightmare on many fronts, including the fact that the cost will be a real nightmare both to the states and to the federal and to the individuals. As of this point, Congress has appropriated only about $40 million, to pay for this out of a cost of $11.2 billion, or including individuals somewhere in the neighborhood of $23 billion. Thank you, and I'll turn it back to you, Charlie.
Okay, thanks. And our last panelist is Nancy Zirkin. Nancy?
Hi, thank you very much. Let me begin by saying that LCCR, the oldest and largest civil rights coalition, believes that Real ID is a real disaster, enacted with no hearings, with minimal debate, and rushed through Congress as a part of an unrelated emergency appropriations measure. The Real ID Act mandates drastic and expensive changes to the manner in which states produce driver's license and other forms of ID. Delaying the implementation does not mitigate the fact that this is a flawed bill, ill-conceived, ineffective, and very, very expensive. Imagine Christmas 2009. Grandma won't be there. She can't take a train or a plane without an ID. Born at home, she doesn't have a birth certificate, a driver's license, or a passport, all prerequisites for the Real ID. Daughter and the grandchildren won't be seeing her. The Real ID is an administrative nightmare. It will cost millions and won't make us any safer. Real ID is a disaster that doesn't need fixing. It needs to be dumped. And that's why the civil rights community is uniformly opposed to it, and that's why many others who are not normally our partners in fighting bad laws, such as the Cato Institute and others, have joined with us in this fight. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to open it up for questions at this point. If you want your question directed to a specific panelist, just let me know. Otherwise, we'll just answer it appropriately. This call is being recorded and will be posted. The remarks will be posted on the ACLU website. So we are now ready for questions.
Yes, sir. At this time, if you have a question, simply press 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Please only press 1 once. If you press it twice, it will remove you from the queue. Our first question, Eric Lipton from the New York Times.
Hi. Yeah, thanks. I'm a little confused about the encryption thing. I guess I thought it says that they recommend that there not be encryption, at least for the address. Isn't that right, Barry?
Well, actually, yeah. Let me answer that. What they say in the proposal is that they are leaning to encryption, but they then begin to lay out all the reasons why encryption may not work.
But then at the end it says, for the above reasons, we have not proposed the encryption be required.
Right.
Okay. So what? How do you read this then?
No, I read it as there is the regulations as they stand now do not require encryption. They have left open the possibility of encryption down the road. So they specifically ask for comments on encryption. But you're correct. The regulations do not themselves now require encryption.
Do not require or explicitly call. They don't call for encryption either. I mean, we have not proposed encryption be required.
No, they have not proposed that. What they have said is that they will entertain comments on whether or not they should require it, but they haven't required it yet.
Yeah.
And you know, and they certainly lay out all the reasons why they don't want to do encryption.
Right.
I mean, the consequence, of course, just so people are clear about this, the consequence of not encrypting the data that's in the so-called machine-readable zone, which will be a form of a barcode, is that everyone in the private sector will be able to simply skim that data off of the card and will skim that data off of the card and will then create new databases with all sorts of motor vehicle driver's license-related data that is now protected under both federal and state law. That DHS understands that and notes that in its comments and in its proposal, but doesn't go as far as to say that they will require encryption, which is really the very first thing that was proposed to them.
This is Bruce Schneier here. I think encryption is largely a red herring here. We are already seeing skimming being done with optical readers. This is a very standardized document, and if the barcode is encrypted, the hotels will grab the information by scanning the front of the printed front, which of course can't be encrypted because it's printed. So I'm not sure what kind of protection you get. I'm certainly a good idea, but don't think because the data is encrypted, there won't be the shadow databases, there won't be the skimming. It'll still happen. It'll just happen optically instead of magnetically.
Okay, we will move on to our next question, and it will come from, I'm sorry if I mispronounced your last name, Ryan Singel with Wire.
Hi, two questions. Could someone give me a little bit more on what the concerns are in terms of databases as outlined in this document, and I'm not really clear on how one goes about getting a certified copy of a birth certificate in terms of expense or having to travel. How does that work, and what are the concerns about that?
I'll start, Barry Steinhardt. Let me answer your questions. The first question on the birth certificate, the answer is for many people it's going to be virtually impossible to get a birth certificate. Or it's going to be very, very difficult to get a birth certificate. It includes not only people born before 1935, who the regulations exempt from requirement of a birth certificate, but includes a lot of people born after 1935. Getting a certified copy of your birth certificate is going to be difficult for an awful lot of people, ranging from people who were born in places where the original birth certificates no longer exist because they were destroyed or lost because of the result of fire or flood or some sort of bureaucratic problems, to simply the difficulty that one has in going to all the many jurisdictions across the country that issue birth certificates and getting a certified copy. The regulations anticipate that there's going to be this national database out there where you can where the government is going to be able to verify the authenticity through certificates. The problem is the database doesn't yet exist, and it's a long way from existing. So that itself was a problem. And your second question, Ryan, was
About the database structure. There had been lots of talk earlier about whether it was going to be kind of a federated system, whether it was going to look something like the commercial driver's license system, whether it was going to be run by a third party, commercial contractor.
Well, that's one of those areas where DHS gets an incomplete. I mean, the truth is we don't know much about the database system, especially when we're talking about the database that will be necessary in order for one state to query another state to determine whether or not someone has a driver's license in another state and to gain the information. Basically, DHS has punted that ball down the field. So we don't know. It's remarkable, really, when you think about this, that nearly 2 years after the statute was passed, that there are so many unanswered questions here. It suggests, to me at least, that maybe these questions don't have answers, that the Congress simply went too far.
Ryan, this is Tim. You get the impression when you read the regs that this is a myth built up upon a dream over at DHS, because most of the database systems that DHS thinks that they're going to be relying on, and I would point people on the call to pages about 40 through about 65 or 60 of the regs. Throughout that section, you get the sense that none of the databases that are supposed to provide the states with the ability to verify documents are in existence now, or even if they are in existence, that they're ready to talk to the other systems. So we've got not only extraordinary technological problems, we've got systems that haven't even yet been designed that DHS is expecting states to begin to use. Furthermore, to answer your second question, a little bit more in detail. The regs say that DHS won't own or control the federated query system that will be established. But nowhere, I believe, in the regs does it say that DHS or other federal agencies won't be tapping into this interlinked national ID system that's been created. And that's exactly what it is, and we have to call it what it is. I think Senator Lamar Alexander said it eloquently yesterday. This is a national ID card, and the federated database system that you've been referring to is the system that backs it up. That's the back-end system that Bruce Schneier is referring to.
Okay, we can move to the next question.
Yes, sir. Next we have Paul Wyckoff from the Star-Ledger of Newark.
Hey, guys. I haven't had a chance to take a look at the regs yet. Tim, what do they say about the how states are supposed to verify all the documents citizens are going to be showing up with to their counters?
Well, there's a series of extended discussions in the regs, and it really your question is a compound and a complex one, Paul, because they can sort of go through document by document and say, well, we considered this, we considered that, but mostly, as I've said, the regs don't yet answer the questions. They really are, as Barry said, incomplete with respect to how states are actually supposed to begin to verify a series of documents. They recognize, I think, the enormous complexity and the flawed basis of the statute that they were handed. But what's remarkable to me is that DHS has had, 21, 22 months to begin to work on this, and they haven't really answered these questions at all. So,
let me ask you one more follow-up. By acceding to the delay idea, do you think DHS will manage to take the wind out of the sails of Akaka, Sununu, Allen, and so on?
I can't really believe so, and that's because we have, and I'd refer to Charlie Mitchell, who's actually hosting the call,
right.
But we have an extraordinary number of states who are acting here, and none of the problems, the underlying fundamental problems with Real ID written into the statute itself, can be resolved with any kind of delay, nor can they be worked around with these regs. So essentially all we've done is kick the can down the road
right.
2 years.
Right.
So we're going to have states, right back at the table 2 years from now saying, can we have another delay, or could you at least finally get rid of this thing?
If I can jump in on that, it's Jim Harper with the Cato Institute.
Uh-huh.
I want to observe also that the DHS is planning to make available Homeland Security grant program funds for Real ID, making me slightly more concerned that the delay will wear down the resolve of states. The federal money tree is shaking, and what the ACLU, I think, rightly calls the surveillance industrial complex will go to work on trying to wear down state resistance using federal money. So this delay is very concerning. It protects Real ID, and Senator Susan Collins' collaboration with the DHS on this is rather surprising, considering that the state of Maine was the first state to outright reject Real ID. Both the House and Senate in the state legislature said, we don't want Real ID, but she's working at cross purposes with her state.
It's Nancy Zirkin of Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. In terms of Kaka, Allen and Sununu and others, what's going to happen, I believe, over the next year, people have alluded to it, is states, more and more states, are going to be enacting laws because it's unworkable. So, as Tim said, kicking the can down the road isn't going to matter. Congress is going to feel the heat and pressure to actually repeal.
Okay, we can take the next question.
Again, reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press 1 and only press 1 once. If you press it twice, it will remove you from the queue. Our next question, Alan Freeman, The Globe and Mail.
Hi, I'm with a Canadian newspaper. In parallel with all this Real ID stuff, we've had this the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative proceeding within DHS and through the states. I'm wondering how you people think this delay will affect what happens with WHTI, and in particular with this proposal from a couple of states to actually try to have enhanced driver's licenses with citizenship shown on it as a replacement for passports. Is this going to further delay WHTI and allow an alternative to come about, or is DHS just going to proceed as it as it wants to by January 2008 or at latest June of 2009?
This is Barry Steinhardt. Well, I never assume a rational response from DHS, unfortunately. But one thing is clear here. It's going to be impossible to use the Real ID card or the Real ID system as the basis for implementing the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, or in this case, crossing, for example, the American-Canadian border. Under the delay that was agreed to today, which we all think is still impossible to meet, even if they could meet it, most Americans would not have the Real ID card until about 2013.
And it wouldn't have citizenship marked on the card either, would it?
No, it would not. You would simply know whether or not the individual was eligible to have a driver's license, to have a real ID card.
About the same, yeah.
Yeah. Which does not necessarily guarantee the person is a citizen. They could, for example, be a permanent resident alien. I understand that there are a number of states, particularly northern tier states in the United States, which have suggested that Real ID is the solution to that problem of crossing the Canadian border, but I think today's developments make it pretty clear that it's not.
Alan, Jim Harper again. WHTI and Real ID are competing rivals for the least coherent security response that the United States has had. And a lot of agencies are thinking of hitching their wagons to Real ID, and that's what I think you're seeing with WHTI, and there are other examples too. They're hitching their wagons to a program that's not going anywhere. The delay that's contemplated by the regs might make agencies think that it's going somewhere, but they'll just learn later rather than sooner that Real ID is not going to be implemented in the U.S., and the state rebellion that's underway right now is the proof of that.
Okay, next question.
Next we have Carol Eisenberg from Newsday.
Mike Chertoff mentioned this morning that several larger states are already, I think he said, well on their way to implementing many of the requirements laid out in the regs. As far as you, and he mentioned California, for instance, and I've heard that informally from some New York officials. Is that true based on what you know?
I'll take that, Jim Harper. I think the folks who characterize states as well on their way are referring to the simplest part of this problem, which is card security. That is, having a card that's of a sufficient design, having data elements on the card that meet Real ID Act requirements. That's not the hard part. The hard part is collection of documentation from Americans who don't have that documentation. It's verification of that documentation with entities that don't provide verification of documentation. So they're not well on their way in terms of the hard part of this project. $17+ billion cost estimate is not spending for card security. It's spending for creating databases that do not exist right now, creating essentially a surveillance infrastructure that the American people will reject.
This is Bruce Schneier. Let me echo that. The card itself is the simplest part of this. The entire security system of issuance, of verification, of update, of revocation, of replacement, all of those ancillary systems are really what cause the expense and what cause the security problems. Right? The reason we'll be more insecure after this than before is not because of the card, it's because of all of those other things.
Okay, next question.
Next we have Nicole Guyette from LA Times.
Hi, Mr. Harper, could you just comment on how this reflects on the government's ability to adopt post-September 11th security measures?
Sure. I think that I do, for the background information of others, I serve on a committee that advises the Department of Homeland Security, the DHS Data Privacy and Integrity Advisory Committee. So I spend a lot of time looking at data-intensive DHS programs. And I think that in the months and the a couple of years after 9/11, we adopted a do anything, do everything mode. And when the threat was unknown and when the responses were unknown, I can't blame our government for having done that. But here, with 5+ years behind us, with no major attack since then, something is working. And at least now is the time to start looking at what does work, what doesn't work. Frankly, to lift the veil of secrecy for many programs that we find very concerning, and to emphasize, work on the programs that do work and get rid of the ones that don't. Students of identification, and I've written a book on identification called Identity Crisis. Students of identification know that a national ID does not secure the country. As Bruce Schneier said, identity is not intentionality, and knowing who somebody is tells you nothing about what they're going to do. So, frankly, as I've said, state governments around the country get this because they've had hearings. Congress has not had a hearing, and they do not get it yet, but they will have to.
Okay, next question.
Okay, next we have Don Applin from BNA.
Hi. I was looking at the regs, and there's really only two mentions of actually what a privacy policy that a state would adopt should look like and what data security measures they should adopt. It just says they should include such things in their certification applications to DHS. And then hidden somewhere in that 120-page preamble is a statement that DHS will issue guidance to states about what certifications should look like. Now, are you surprised that all there is there are those two little mentions of, there's nothing like here are some payment card industry type data security standards or here are some specific privacy measures you should take?
This is Tim Sparapani. I'm not surprised at all. We began meeting with DHS intensively with people from the left, the right, the center, privacy experts, security experts shortly after the enactment of the Real ID Act in May of 2005, and we pleaded with them to listen to reason and to build in robust privacy and security safeguards at that time. And those requests have clearly fallen on deaf ears. And here we find ourselves in a situation where we can expect, if Real ID is ever implemented, that it will actually probably increase in a manifold way the amount and intensity of identity theft that occurs in this country rather than actually reducing it. We're going to have a system that's going to be essentially wide open from a computing standpoint, accessible by hundreds of thousands, if not millions of government employees, with little or no robust security safeguards. And you can tell that DHS has not yet done the hard work to think about how to secure what is probably the largest single database of information about U.S. people that's ever been contemplated.
Yeah, this is Bruce Steyer again. Let me talk about that. Identity theft is a bad crime for two reasons. One, identity information is easy to steal, and two, it is more valuable once stolen. A single database, as opposed to a distributed system, makes the data easier to steal because it's all in one place, even though there'll be safeguards. And when you steal it, it is so much more valuable. I mean, if you think impersonating someone to your bank is bad, try impersonating someone to the TSA. I mean, this will actually make identity theft worse. I think it's a very real fear, and we should be worried about that.
This is Barry Steinhardt. If we just add one informational point, Beth Gibbons from the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse actually posted a statement on her website today. You can find that statement actually also on the Real Nightmare, linked to on the realnightmare.org site. By the end of this call, I will get you the exact internet address for that statement. But it's important to recognize that Beth Gibbons is probably one of the nation's premier experts on the issue of identity theft. And as her statement makes clear, as Bruce Schneier just said, the creation of the Real ID system, not just the card, but the Real ID system, will dramatically worsen the problem of identity theft in the United States.
If I can jump in on this good question as well, Jim Harper with Cato. I was a participant in the meeting that Tim helped put together with the DHS Real ID Working Group, and I suggested a couple of times that they needed to require these databases to be subject to the rules of the Privacy Act of 1974. That's the act that governs databases held by U.S. government agencies. Now, apparently they've declined to do that, meaning that this is a federally required database, but it's outside the scope of the Privacy Act. So they've outsourced surveillance of American drivers to non-U.S. government entities, and they're going to use the data and have access to the data all the same. The already low protections of the Privacy Act are being subverted by this the Real ID Act.
Just to finish, close the loop here, the statement of the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, which begins by saying, if you think identity theft is bad now, wait until something called the Real ID Act goes into effect, can be found at their website, which is privacyrights.org.
Okay, next question.
As a reminder, again, if you'd like to ask a question, simply press 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Please only press 1 once. If you press it twice, it will remove you from the queue. Okay, we have a question, again, from Ryan Single from Wired.
One of the things I didn't notice in there, and I was wondering if somebody saw, was what happens when your address changes. They require that your address be on this document, which I've never really understood because your passport does not need that. But I didn't see in there what's going to happen. Are people going to have to go back to the DMV every time their address changes?
Brian, this is Tim Sparapani. I read that the statute as requiring that every person in America, every time they move, has to go back and get a new Real ID license. So they're going to have to go through this nightmarish process all over again. They actually refer in the regulations to the definition of principal address from Black's Law Dictionary. They say that they surveyed all the DMVs and state statutes around the country and couldn't find a commonly accepted definition. And that principal address that they refer to says the place that a person actually resides has to be on the face of their license. Now, as a lawyer, I would say that if you're interpreting the statute honestly and you're interpreting that regulatory requirement honestly, that means that every time somebody in America moves, they're going to have to get a new Real ID license. Every time a renter moves from property to property. When people move south for the winter and then back north again, they may have to get a new address and then therefore a new license.
Thanks, Tim.
Okay, is there any more questions?
We do have another question from Carol Eisenberg from Newsday.
Hi. You talked earlier about how information on the card could be skimmed. I'm not at all technically sophisticated. Can you explain how that would happen?
This is Bruce Schneier. Let me talk about that. There are sort of two ways to skim information on the card, and these are both done. There are examples, I forget which state, where bars will routinely grab information for marketing purposes. You can read the mag stripe on the back of your license and grab the information that way. And that's just a mirror of the information on the front. Depending on your state, you might have a 2D optical barcode on your back. Again, it's the same information, and you can skim it that way. The third way is to just photocopy the front of the license. But the information is all there, and then you either use OCR technology, optical character recognition, to move that into a database or do it manually. Right? Manually, of course, is the ugly, slow way. So there are many ways to get that information. If there's an RFID chip in these cards, there's a potential for skimming surreptitiously while the card is sitting in your wallet, in your pocket. So there's a lot of ways to skim the information because it gets available in a variety of formats.
But that is true now.
Well,
yes.
This is Barry Steinhardt. Let me add one thing, which is what is very different about Real ID from our current situation is right now we have 56 jurisdictions out there that issue driver's licenses, and they issue them in a variety of formats. So it's and they have different information on the face of the license and different information on the machine-readable part of the license, which is generally, as apparently would remain under these regulations, a 2D barcode. The problem is that Real ID sets up a uniform set of not only a uniform set of data, but a uniform format throughout the country. So you essentially have a system where you have 56 jurisdictions all issuing the same driver's license with the same format, the same data. The only thing that's going to be substantially different are some of the cosmetics, what photograph is on it or how, you know, what color it is. That's going to make it possible to create both equipment that can be used across the country to harvest the information that's on the driver's license by legitimate and illegitimate people, and also will further the creation of large national databases. That's what's so insidious about Real ID, in many respects, is its uniformity and the unwillingness of DHS to even take the minimal efforts and propose the minimal steps to protect that data from being harvested.
Which would be what, the minimal steps?
Well,
you're talking encryption?
At a minimum, the machine-readable component ought to be encrypted. The material that's printed on the face of the license doesn't need to be uniform. It doesn't need to be in a uniform format. We can have laws, as we do in some states now, that prohibit private parties from harvesting that data. DHS specifically, in its description of the regulations today, punted again on the question of whether or not they would require those kinds of regulations. So there are any number of things they could have done to at least minimize this problem that they chose not to do.
I want to note one more time that the ACLU has a lot of this information at www.realnightmare.org, and if you have questions after, the ACLU press line is 202-675-2312. Excuse me. Are there any more questions?
Again, if you have a question, please press 1 now. At this time, there are no further questions.
Okay, thank everyone for participating in this recording, and this will be posted on the ACLU webpage. Thank you.